Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Hello, my name is Les Crest, and I welcome you to our weekly program, We the People. The Constitution Matters, which airs each Friday at this time. This broadcast is also repeated during our weekend program schedule. Each week we have a distinguished panel of experts who are here to discuss our topic of the week. And joining us today, David Whitney, pastor and senior instructor at the Institute on the Constitution in Pasadena, Maryland. And joining us again this week is Sam Rohrer, president of the Pennsylvania Pastors Network and the American Pastors Network. And our special guest today, we're glad to have Mr. William J. Federer. He's a nationally known speaker, best-selling author, and president of Amerisearch Incorporated, a publishing company dedicated to researching America's noble heritage. And our coordinator again today is Mr. Gary Porter, executive director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative in Yorktown, Virginia. So, Gary, would you introduce today's topic, and let's begin our discussion.
Well, gladly, and thanks, Les, for that introduction. We've been talking these last several weeks about the role of pastors and the mix of pastors and politics. And we spent a lot of time reviewing just why there is a reluctance, or seems to be a reluctance, on the part of pastors to get involved in the political arena. We blame some of that on the 501c3 status that most churches enjoy and the guidelines, however innocuous they are, that the IRS has put out in order to maintain that status. But even churches can do, and pastors can do a whole lot and stay within those guidelines. The guidelines are really very limited in terms of their prohibitions. So we've been talking about why it's necessary for pastors to speak out, and I was in a conference last week where I encountered a book by Bill Federer called Backfired, subtitle, A Nation Founded on Religious Tolerance No Longer Tolerates Its Founders' Religion. And it's a wonderful little compendium of recent events that have met the headlines and have shown us just how important it is for pastors to be speaking out today. Because there is a very concerted effort, if you even take a moment to look at the evidence, a concerted effort in this country to suppress the Christian religion and suppress Christianity in general, which is greatly ironic because of the role that Christianity played in the formation of this country and the building of the country and to be the greatest nation and the strongest nation on earth. So I find it greatly ironic that there's this trend and actually organized effort to suppress Christianity. And Bill's book is a wonderful bit of evidence that shows you just how pervasive this effort has been. And so I asked Bill to come on and talk about the book and to talk about this whole idea of Christianity being suppressed today. The evidence is clear. The evidence is unmistakable that there are certain groups that are that are bent on suppressing Christianity, pushing it back within the four walls of the churches, and not having any visible evidence that Christianity is even part of our culture. So with that kind of a lead-in, Bill, would you like to tell us a little bit about what prompted you to write this book?
Well, thank you, Gary, and I have been getting your newsletter and wanted to let everyone know they need to sign up for your newsletter, Gary Porter. It's just excellent, gives background. We obviously see how they are taking God out of our schools and telling kids they can't pray and having the military removing Bibles from the Walter Reed Hospital and telling chaplains they can't pray in the name of Jesus. And and if you go back, you'll see, as you mentioned, the Christian founding of the country. Now, if we go a little bit back further, it begins to tie in with something that we can relate to today. ISIS, well, back then it was called the Ottoman Empire. It was the Islamic State. And in 1529, the Muslim Ottoman state, the ISIS of the day, was scourging through Central Europe and surrounding Vienna, Austria. And the leader was Suleiman the Magnificent, and he boasted of wanting to conquer the world. And this is just 12 years after Martin Luther had started the Reformation. Well, they were able to resist the advance of Suleiman this time. They continue their attack, but Martin Luther said, "The Turk is the rod of the wrath of the Lord our God. If the Turk's God, the devil, is not beaten first, there is reason to fear the Turk will not be so easy to beat. The fight against the Turk must begin with repentance. We must reform our lives or we shall fight in vain." John Calvin wrote in 1543, "I hear the sad condition of your Germany. The Turk again prepares to wage war with a larger force. Who will stand up and oppose his marching throughout the land at his mere will and pleasure?" Later, John Wesley writes, "Ever since the religion of Islam appeared in the world, the espousers of it have been as wolves and tigers to all other nations, rending and tearing all that fell into their merciless paws." Well, the Holy Roman Emperor at the time was Charles V of Spain. Yes, the same Charles V that Martin Luther stood in front of. At that time, he was only 21 years old. But by the year 1555, Charles V is an old man. He is the king. And he decides the Muslim threat is so great that he would strike a deal with the Protestants. It is called the Peace of Augsburg of 1555. This is the first treaty ever to recognize the Protestants. And in this Treaty of Augsburg of 1555 is a little Latin phrase that made a big difference. The phrase was, "Cuius regio, ius religio," which means, whose is the reign, his is the religion. So this was Charles V of Spain saying, look, guys, believe whatever you want in your kingdoms. Let's just unite against this Muslim invasion. And it worked. They were able to stop the Muslim invasion any further into Europe. But it started a domino effect across Europe, where the different kings decided to believe slightly different things. So northern Germany and Sweden were Lutheran, Switzerland Calvinist, and Scotland Presbyterian, England Anglican, Holland Dutch Reformed, and of course Italy, Spain, France, Austria, Poland remained Roman Catholic, Greece was Greek Orthodox, Russia was Russian Orthodox, Serbia was Serbian Orthodox. You get the picture, it was one denomination per country. It was whatever the king got to believe, his kingdom had to believe. And if you didn't believe the way the king did, you were persecuted, you fled, and so there was this mass migration of people shifting around Europe in the 1600s simply for conscience' sake. And those were the ones that spilled over and founded colonies in America. And I read through every charter of every colony. Every colony was started by a different Christian denomination. Virginia was Anglican from 1606 to 1786. Massachusetts was Puritan. Rhode Island was founded by Baptists. New York was founded by Dutch Reformed. Delaware and New Jersey were founded by Swedish Lutherans. Connecticut and New Hampshire were founded by Congregationalists. Maryland by Catholic, Pennsylvania by Quakers. You get the picture. It was one denomination per colony. Their attitude was similar to Europe's. And it was, if you don't like our denomination, fine, start your own colony. And there was a couple of experiments like Philadelphia and Rhode Island. They let some of the others in. But by and large, that was the situation until the Revolutionary War started. And then they had to work together against the King of England. After the Revolution, their attitude was, we may not agree on religion all the time, but you were willing to fight and die for my freedom. I need to let you practice your faith. And so then we begin to see, I actually read through every state constitution. Now, before I go on, I wanted to pause, Gary, and see if you or anyone had questions.
Well, so there we are with a different religion in each colony, at least a predominant religion. There were obviously others that believed differently, even within the colonies. But I noticed that in your American Minute that you sent out recently, you point to an incident in 1774 where we had the Boston, 1773, where we had the Boston Tea Party, and the reaction to that was closing of the port of Boston, and the reaction to that was calling for a day of prayer and fasting on the 1st of June, 1774, when the Boston Port Act was to go into effect. So the whole colonies, despite their having different predominant denominations, all of the colonies were united in coming together for a day of prayer and fasting. How different we have a situation we have today. Could the nation be called together for a day of prayer and fasting today?
I think that the pastors could maybe call it. I don't know if the president would call it. But, you know, we hear the president commented about the Crusades. It's interesting how they had an effect on Europe similar to the way the Revolutionary War had on America. What do I mean? As the Muslims conquered North Africa, and they conquered Syria, and they conquered the Middle East, and they conquered Spain, they were unstoppable primarily because their enemies were divided. You had the Byzantine Christians persecuting the Coptic Christians of Egypt, and the Muslims took over. North Africa, their version of separation of church and state that the Christians had in the 7th century was this hyper-pietism, where if you got to become a Christian, you were expected to give away all your money and live in a cave. It was this removal of yourself from affecting society. Just live within your four walls. Have it be a personal religion, but certainly don't. And as a result, Islam was unopposed and conquered North Africa. There were some warring Christian Visigothic kingdoms in Spain, and one of them brings the Muslims over to help their side. The Muslims conquer it all. And then you have the Greek Orthodox Christians and the Roman Catholic Christians there when it comes to Turkey. And because of that division, Islam advances. And then later you have France making treaties with the Muslims against Russia, England, and Spain. And so whenever there is division, Islam comes in and takes over it all. And so,
Bill, I'm going to jump in here right now. This is Sam. I got a question for you in regard to that, because I think you really laid out a great overview of the history in Europe and coming over here and the way things started, and that ultimately, which you did, you stopped at that point, but ultimately the colonies came together because of a common interest, and that obviously led to what we have here now. The president just the other day, actually 2 days ago, in his speech, and I know you referred to it, but in that speech he talked about the significant role of Islam and Muslims in the founding of our country, which most people scratch their heads and say, what influence? I'd like you to comment on that. And then number two, Gary asked the question of could we pull together a national day of prayer, and you said not under this president, which I would agree, pastors could do it, but there was one thing that the president has been saying and those who were at this summit in Washington have been hearing, and that is this incessant emphasis on pluralism. We are a pluralistic society, this is the goal, this is where we are, and we're all alike. Comment on those two things, because I think they're key for our listeners to understand here today.
Sure. Well, thank you. Well, as the Muslims conquered, it caused the Europeans to send help. And the Byzantine Empire, which is today Turkey, was being invaded by the Muslims. All seven churches mentioned in the book of Revelation were wiped out by the Muslims. And so the Greeks had to beg the West for help. The Greeks were proud. They saw themselves as the true Christians because they spoke Greek, the language of the New Testament. Their land was where John spoke and Paul spoke. And they viewed the Latin Catholic West as the church split. Matter of fact, they officially split in the year 1054 over two words in the Nicene Creed. The Greeks said the Holy Spirit proceeded from the Father, and the Catholic West said the Holy Spirit proceeded from the Father and the Son. Now, as important as doctrinal issues are to the Muslims, they could care less. They want to kill them all. And as the Muslims are invading Greece, they send help to Pope Urban II, and he goes to the Council of Clermont, and he tells these Christian kings to leave the 99 and go after the one, like Jesus said, and leave your country and go help these Christians that are being killed in Syria and over in the Middle East, like they're being killed today. And so they send help. It's called the Crusades. There's nine major crusades in 200 years. Richard the Lionheart led the Third Crusade, left his brother King John in charge of England. That's where you had the Sherwood Forest and the taxes and the Nottingham and Robin Hood. So that was the Third Crusade period. I'm speaking to you from a city named after the guy who led the Seventh and Eighth Crusades, St. Louis. I'm in St. Louis, Missouri, but St. Louis was the king of France, King Louis IX, and he led the Seventh and Eighth Crusades against the Muslims. And so the Crusades caused Europe to see itself not as individual little kingdoms, but as this united thing called Europe, called Christendom, similar to the revolution against King George III and him sending his military over caused the 13 individual colonies to begin to see themselves as United States. And had the Muslims invaded Europe a couple centuries earlier, Europe was so disorganized, the Muslims would have conquered it very easily. So in a sense, the Crusades saved Europe by buying them two centuries and letting Europe coalesce into Europe. When the Crusades ended, the Muslims surrounded Constantinople, and they sacked it in the year 1453, which effectively cut off the land routes to India and China. And so in 1492, Columbus set sail looking for a sea route to India and China. So Marco Polo in 1271 went from Venice, Italy to China and worked for Kublai Khan and brought back to Europe spaghetti, coal, gunpowder, talked about Chinese having thread from worms, talked about the Chinese inventing paper currency, talked about the Chinese having plates that were made out of porcelain, and they called it China. And then India had teas, dyes, and spices. And so because the Europeans wanted to trade with India and China, and the Muslims conquered the trade routes, like Tamerlane, this Muslim leader that killed 17 million people across Central Asia, wiped out the Christian church in Central Asia. We forget, Central Asia used to have lots of Christians, but Tamerlane left pyramids of skulls and had a Quran so big they had to carry it around in a wheelbarrow. But when the Muslims finally sacked Constantinople in 1453, it ended the land trade routes, and that's when Columbus set sail looking for a sea route to India and China. He names the people he meets, what? Indians. Why did he name them Indians? Because he thought he was in India. Why was he trying to get to India? Because ISIS, the Islamic State of the day, the Ottoman Muslims, cut off the land routes to India. So we would never even have called Native Americans Indians if it was not for Islamic Jihad and the Islamic State. And so the Muslims continued to invade, and surrounding Vienna, Austria twice, and invading into Serbia and Wallachia, Moldova and Poland, and those Eastern Europeans were fighting all the battles that allowed Western Europe to develop.
Did we lose Bill?
I'm sorry? Am I still with you?
Yes.
Okay. I'll pause here. Is there any questions or comments?
Well,
from my perspective, is really, really helpful, because what you're laying out is that, people who are listening and watching secular news and regular news in addition to this program are seeing what's happening in Washington, and they're hearing things that are causing many to scratch their head and say, how can this be? What you're saying is that Muslim influence over the centuries has, in fact, had a significant impact on where we are, but not because they participated in this whole experiment, but because over time they perhaps were the catalyst to force those who were non-Muslims to coalesce and stand together as they did in Europe, and triggered a lot of things which perhaps even somewhat led to the discovery, from God's perspective, I mean from providential perspective, of the United States. Is that right?
Yeah. Another thing is the Dark Ages. And you think, what are the Dark Ages? Well, that was when there was a paper shortage in Europe, and they wrote less books, and literacy declined. Well, what started the Dark Ages? When the Muslims conquered Egypt, they held back the ships of papyrus, which was the paper of the day, reeds that grew along the Nile that they would dry out and glue together. And so they cut off trade across the Mediterranean and trade in the important product of paper, papyrus. And so the Muslims, in a very real sense, contributed to Europe entering the Dark Ages for centuries. And then when the Muslims invaded Greece and the Byzantine Empire, all the Greek scholars fled further west to Florence, Italy, and they brought with them their Greek art, architecture, literature, and we call this renewed interest in Greek stuff the Renaissance. So Islam's responsible for the Dark Ages, and Islam's responsible for the Renaissance, albeit in a backward sense. But then, coming from Greece, were the Greek scholars carrying their Greek New Testaments. And so this led the Europeans to begin to translate the Bible, not just to Latin, but all the way back to Greek. Like Erasmus, the priest that corresponded with Luther, and he translated the Bible into Greek. And so this helped lead to the Reformation. So in a backward sense, Islam contributed to the Reformation. And as the Muslims conquered the East, civilization fled west.
I'd like to bring us up to 1774 again, and quote one thing that you included in your American Minute yesterday or today, and that's concerning William Prescott. I said, as the result of the Boston Port Bill, all the colonies united and sent goods to Boston. And William Prescott said, "We heartily sympathize with you and are always ready to do all in our power for your support, comfort, and relief, knowing that Providence has placed you where you must stand the first shock. We consider we are all embarked in the same ship and must sink or swim together. If we submit to these regulations," meaning the port bill, "all is gone. Our forefathers passed the vast Atlantic, spent their blood and treasure that we might enjoy their liberties, both civil and religious, and transmit them to our posterity. Now, if we should give them up, can our children rise up and call us blessed?" That's the situation I see us in today. We are really being suppressed, and we've got to sink or swim. We will sink or swim together. The pastors have to come together and combat this this force of suppression that I see going on today. What do you see it that way?
I certainly do. And I read through every charter of every colony, and then I read through every state constitution, and I found some interesting things. Between 1776 and 1790, 9 states required you to be a Protestant Christian to hold state office. South Carolina, its constitution in 1778 said the Christian Protestant religion is hereby deemed the established religion of this state. The same with North Carolina and Georgia and Connecticut. And Catholics were only allowed in 3 colonies. And there's only 1,500 Jews in the whole country.
We need to take a break at this point. We'll invite you to stay tuned. We'll be back after these messages and Fox News.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge Piece of Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Welcome back to our program, We the People, the Constitution Matters. Joining us in this segment, David Whitney, pastor and senior instructor at the Institute on the Constitution in Pasadena, Maryland. And as we did in the last segment, we are talking to Mr. William J. Federer, author, historian, lecturer, and author of the book Backfired, A Nation Founded on Religious Tolerance No Longer Tolerates Its Founder's Religion. Let's go back to you, Mr. Federer, and pick up where we left off.
Well, I had mentioned how as the Muslims had conquered on the east, the Greek scholars fled to Florence, Italy, and brought with them their Greek art, architecture, literature, which began the Renaissance. And then they brought with them their Greek New Testaments, which caused the European scholars to translate the Bible all the way back to Greek, and that laid the foundation for the Reformation. And then there was the Holy Roman Emperor, once the Reformation started, began to see this dilemma of the Protestant Reformation on one side and the Muslims surrounding Vienna, Austria on the other side. And so that's when he strikes a deal with the Protestants called the Peace of Augsburg. Just let every king decide what's going to be believed in his kingdom. There's this mass migration across Europe. Simply for conscience sake, those were the ones that spilled over and founded colonies in America. So every colony was started by a different Christian denomination. They did not get along. Maine, they would, you know, tar and feather the priests, and the Quakers were chased out of New York, and the Dutch Reform chased out the Swedish Lutherans, and the Massachusetts, they not only hung witches, 19 of them, they hung Quakers, four Quakers were hung as heretics. And so as the Muslims invaded Europe is what caused the civilization to flee further west. But then I read through every state constitution, and I found it fascinating that right there in black and white, you had the different states established as Christian. So South Carolina's original constitution said that the Christian Protestant religion is hereby deemed the established religion of this state. Can't get any clearer than that. I think it was established a Christian state. North Carolina's original state constitution says that no person who denies the being of God or the truth of the Protestant religion shall hold any office in this state. That was in effect up until 1835 when they changed it to say no person who denies the being of God or the truth of the Christian religion shall hold any office in the state. That was in effect up until 1868 when they said all you got to do is believe in God. Wow, where do the atheists fit in? I don't think. And then Maryland. It was a Catholic colony. Then it was taken over by the Anglicans. The Catholics were considering to migrating to the Louisiana French Catholic territory until the Revolution started. They jumped in and fought. And after the war, when Maryland issued its first constitution in 1776, it said that every office holder had to make a declaration of belief in the Christian religion. We think of that as narrow-minded. They thought of that as being generous because by saying Christian, you could be any denomination of Protestant and even Catholic.
Bill?
Yes.
So how did we get from what you're describing there in the colonial period where Christianity was the recognized predominant religion, if not even the official religion in the colonies, to the situation today where Christianity, where you cannot even pray at a a Board of Supervisors meeting. You can't even hold prayer because the ACLU says that's a violation of our First Amendment. How did we go from one to the other? What's your view of that?
A very important question, and it happened in three stages. First was the Irish potato famine. So in 1776, 98% of America was Protestant. Catholics were only allowed in three colonies, Maryland, New York, and Pennsylvania, and they did not have even full rights in those. 30,000 Catholics in a country of 3 million. And then there's only 1,500 Jews in the whole country, seven synagogues, that's it. And so it was a 98% Protestant country. But then the Irish potato famine happens in the early 1800s. Millions die over there in Ireland, and millions come across to America, to the port cities of Philadelphia, New York, Boston. And the Catholic percentage in America goes from 2% to 20% in just 10 years. And so there's this large anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant, anti-Irish backlash, and it gradually settles down. And the but in the meantime, laws got on the books to prevent tax money from going to these Catholic schools. And so different colonies had started common schools for the poor immigrant kids, and they would only teach what they held in common, like the King James Bible, like the Our Father, the Ten Commandments, basic Christian theology. When the Catholics came over, they objected. They say the Ten Commandments in a different order. They split the tenth one, and they combine the first and the second one. It's the same content. It sort of goes back to the difference between the way the Hebrews and the Greeks would list it. Then the Catholics didn't like the way the Protestants said the Our Father. You know, the Protestants say, "For thine is the kingdom, power, and glory forever and ever. Amen," at the end of it. They didn't like that, and they would demonstrate in the street. And they had different priests that were part of the religious wars in Europe, and so they sort of brought over their religious war mentality to America. Anyway, they stoned the Archbishop's house in New York. They burnt five Catholic churches in Philadelphia. They raided convents in Boston. And so finally the Catholics pull their kids out of the common schools and start their parochial Catholic school system. And so the Protestant public school system and the Catholic parochial school system were the two education systems in a country. Then you had the laws get on the books to prevent tax money from going to these Catholic schools. They called them sectarian schools. The second thing was evolution, with Charles Darwin and his Origin of Species in 1859. And then a guy named Herbert Spencer said, "Well, gee, if species can evolve, maybe everything else can evolve, including laws." And so he introduced the idea of laws evolving, and a leader at Harvard, Christopher Columbus Langdell, head of the law school, he applies evolution to the legal process and calls it the case precedent theory of law. So instead of going back to what the founders intended, you just take the most recent case and you can bend the piece of rebar a little at a time till it's going in the opposite direction. That influenced a student at Harvard, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., and Teddy Roosevelt mistakenly put him on the Supreme Court, and he began to apply this legal interpretation to the Supreme Court. Forget what the founder said, just take the most recent case and bend it a little more. So we got the first stage is the Irish potato famine. The second stage is evolution applied to the legal process. But the third stage was the 14th Amendment. Now, the first 10 amendments were the states limiting the federal government's power. But the 13th Amendment was the federal government telling the states they could not have slavery. The 14th Amendment was the federal government forcing the states to give rights to the freed slaves. The 15th Amendment was the federal government forcing the states to have the freed slaves voting. But this was a different kind of amendment. This was the federal government telling the states what they can and cannot do, whereas the first 10 amendments were the states telling the federal government what they cannot do. And so there were these activist judges applying evolution to the legal process, to the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment was used to say that this, and I think you even had this in your newsletter, Gary, but there was a guy named Filburn who was a farmer, and yep. He was growing. You want to tell the story?
Well, that deals with the Commerce Clause and how that clause has been morphed by the courts and starting in the 1930s. But the situation we face today, though, is what you're getting to is a twisting of the First Amendment and 1947's Everson versus Board of Education, where this wall of separation theory came up. You know, all that leads up to this 1947 case, and that's the situation we find today. Is we have this convoluted feeling of what the First Amendment really says, instead of what James Madison intended it to accomplish, and that has led now to this separation that was never intended, never desired, which atheists and secularists have capitalized on.
You're right. And so the federal government was usurping power, and a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time. And so,
are we still alive?
The Filburn was a farmer who was feeding his hay to his cows, and the federal government says, you're affecting the state of interstate commerce because you're not buying hay on the market and you're not selling your hay on the market. So the federal government got involved. Then there was Jehovah's Witnesses, and they were going door to door, and states said, no, it's a nuisance. And the federal government says, oh, they get to do that, freedom of religion. And then you had the Mormons wanting to have plural wives. And we said, well, government, courts get involved. And thankfully they stopped it there. And then the Jehovah's Witnesses would pass out pamphlets saying, don't pledge allegiance to the flag. And the states would say, no, we're not going to have that. Well, they'd go to the federal government. These activist judges would say, oh, well, freedom of press, they can print that stuff. It got to the place where Jehovah's Witnesses were setting up their speakers. They just came out with, the audio speakers and outside of churches and parks, and they would hold their services at the same time the church was, and they would be real loud on their loudspeakers telling everybody inside they're going to hell. And the states would try to stop it, and the federal government said, oh, freedom of assembly, they keep meeting. And finally, in the 1947, some Catholic kids were getting bus rides and to their schools, and the states said, no, you can't, because of these anti-sectarian laws. And the federal government takes control of religion by saying, oh, no, they get to do the bus rides, but from now on, we're in charge of the religion. And the federal government began to morph it into an unrecognizable form. So originally, religion was under the jurisdiction of the 13 states. Some states had blue laws, Connecticut, Massachusetts, where you couldn't ride in your carriage on a Sunday, and other states didn't. Sort of like today, some states have smoking bans and others don't. Some states have gay marriage and others don't. Some states had gambling and others don't. Back then, some states gave a little more religious freedom and some states didn't. But it was up to the people in the states to decide what they wanted. That's the way it was up until 1947. Hugo Black, put on the Supreme Court by Franklin Roosevelt in the Everson case, gave a little phrase that changed it all. It was, the First Amendment means at least this, neither the federal government nor any state can have established religion. Wait a second. The states did have established religions, established denominations. I mean, Connecticut and Massachusetts were established congregational all the way up until like the 1818 and 1830. And so he changed it from the First Amendment limiting the federal government's power to the federal government applying the First Amendment to the states. What they're meaning is the federal government is taking the handcuffs off its wrists and putting the handcuffs on the state's wrists. And so that is the big change. And in 1957, there was a Washington Ethical Society that wanted tax-exempt status as a religious organization. The IRS said, no, you're an ethical society, but it's the Supreme Court said ethical culture is a religion. They get to be tax-exempt. 1960, a draft dodger in 1960, a guy wanted to be a notary in Maryland but didn't want to say, so help me God, at the end of his oath. The state said no. The Supreme Court said there are new religions that do not acknowledge a supreme being. He gets to be the notary. 1970, a draft dodger wanted to claim religious conscientious objector status as an atheist, and the Army said no, he sues, and the Supreme Court said he gets to be a conscientious objector because atheism is a religion. And so now, to not prefer one religion over the other, they kick God out.
Bill, that's where we're at today, and thank you, because that is just amazing to see how we have gone from one end of the perspective where all Christian religions, all Christian denominations were respected. And yet what's happened in the pulpit of America today, I think, is part of that whole picture of where we have gone off key. If the pulpits had continued to emphasize that not only are we a Christian nation, that citizens have a duty to understand that their Christian religion is absolutely essential to the preservation of this constitutional republic, some of those dangerous turns, like in 1947, might have been avoided or might have been pushed back had the people been educated from the pulpits of America on what their role as a Christian citizen is. First of all, pastors ought to be teaching today the biblical view of law and government that our founders clearly upheld, and actually it's in our founding document, the Declaration of Independence. Very simply, it is this: there is a creator God, and that God is the God of the Bible, not Allah, not Buddha, not any other deity. The God of the Bible is the creator God. And secondly, that our God-given rights come from Him. They don't come from government. Government can't create them. Government doesn't manipulate them. Governments exist only for the purpose of protecting those God-given rights. But I think because the pulpits in America largely have been silent in training their people to think biblically about law and government, what we have is that these things have just gone unopposed by Christians. And so we reached the point today where Christians are being persecuted by state governments and by the federal government. And most Christians say, well, I guess that's just the way we have to endure it, because they do not have a biblical view of law and government. As I ran for office a number of times here in the state of Maryland, and the last time I ran, I was attacked all over the country. And this is a little local race, just in a county council race, but attacked all over the country by these leftists who hate anyone who espouses simply what our founders clearly said. There is a creator God. Our rights come from Him. The only purpose of government is to secure and protect those God-given rights. And the term they like to use is, you're a theocrat. You're trying to impose your religion on the rest of us. Well, the truth of the matter is, they have opposed, just as you've pointed out in the case with several cases there with the Supreme Court, what we have had imposed upon us is an anti-Christian religion. Atheistic secular humanism is a religion. It has been opposed upon us. And I would say that the failure that's taken place in America is pastors have fallen down on the job of proclaiming the whole counsel of God, particularly what God's Word says regarding law and government, because Christians don't have that worldview. They don't know how to stand against the atheistic secular humanists, which, by the way, are a very, very teeny minority in our country. Most of the people in Congress, vast majority of them claim to be Christians. 80% of those in America plus claim to be Christians. If all of those Christians said, wait a minute, excuse me, you atheistic secular humanists, you only have God-given rights, even though you don't believe in God, and the only purpose of government is to secure your God-given rights, even though you don't believe in that God, and the only thing we're going to allow government to do is to secure God-given rights, and therefore, sorry, atheistic secular humanist, you don't have a standing to promote your atheistic secular humanism in our public schools or in our courts, in Congress, anywhere, because it is an anti-American belief system, which if you allow that anti-American belief system to prevail, what you have done is you have changed our constitutional republic into something else, an atheistic secular humanist tyranny, not a true constitutional republic. So the pulpits, and what needs to take place for pastors in the pulpits, is to proclaim a clear message about what God's Word says about law and government. And I know from talking with many pastors, many feel very challenged or like they're not equipped to do that. Seminary doesn't train them to do that. And that's why I've been participating for more than a decade now with Institute on the Constitution, where we prepare materials to help pastors do that, help pastors train up Christian citizens who have a biblical worldview of law and of government.
Okay, we've got about 7 minutes left. Sam, did you want to comment on what we've been talking about?
Well, you know, in listening, as we all have, to the great discussion here today, and I want to go back again. I brought the questioner earlier, but Dave, let me go to you on this, because I asked Bill this question, but the president has been talking about this concept of pluralism. I think there's a dominant thought in our culture that when we as American citizens
sit here and understanding the First Amendment, in which guarantees the right for people to worship as they please and so forth, that really of necessity means anybody and everything, no matter what it is, and the concept that it's a more of a glorified position to have this, we are all together in this one pot, but not understanding, in my opinion, that it cannot continue without one dominant world view. Talk to us a little bit about that part and how a pastor should be able to deal with that issue, if you could.
Well, thank you so much, Sam, because one of the mistakes many people believe is that somehow if you allow a multiplicity of, well, we could call them belief systems, not really theologies, because there's only one true theology, biblical theology, but we can allow a number of competing belief systems to all reign supreme in a society, and, you know, everybody can choose whatever they believe. Well, we know very clearly, just as Bill has been sharing with us, if the Mohammedan religion prevails, you're going to wind up with Sharia law in which no one has any of their God-given rights protected. In fact, not even the Mohammedans themselves. So our founders recognized that there are true religions, that is, all the branches of Orthodox Christianity, and there are false religions. In fact, if you go to Webster's 1828 dictionary, you can see in the definition of the word religion what our founders understood. There's true religion, and there are false religions. And those false religions, the history of the world shows again and again, just as Bill has detailed there with the Mohammedans, they don't produce liberty. They produce tyranny. And there is only one religion that provides liberty not only for the adherents to that religion, that is, their God-given rights protected, but the adherents of other religions also have their God-given rights protected, and that is Orthodox Christianity. If you veer away from Orthodox Christianity, whether it's Mohammedanism or Hinduism or Buddhism or any of the other isms of the world, you will find a form of tyranny is what those religions ultimately produce in that society, because they do not allow the liberty of conscience for the individual, whereas Orthodox Christianity will protect someone, like an atheist, protect his God-given rights, even though we do not permit him to advance his theory of government to destroy the rights of other people. And again, this comes back, in my opinion, to the teaching that needs to take place from the pulpit, is that liberty involves obedience to God's law. Liberty is not license, that is, doing whatever you please. Mm-hmm. That's anarchy. Judges describes as every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Liberty is the result of a society coordinating and putting together an obedience to the law of God, starting with the Ten Commandments. There you will find true liberty, because that's the way God has designed it for human civil government.
And David, I've often used the expression that true civil freedom, such as what we have had here in this country, can only happen once there's been an experience of true spiritual freedom in the biblical sense. And I mean, that's really what you're describing, just put in a different way. Bill, you may have one last comment. I know we have a few minutes left before we conclude here, but do you have any comments just to kind of fill in the gap on that and how pastors can understand this issue?
Sure, and of course, the title of the book that I had talked about is called Backfired, A Nation Born for Religious Tolerance No Longer Tolerates the Religion of Its Founders. My website's AmericanMinute.com. Did want to throw in, I sent out a free daily email called American Minute. I think Gary may have mentioned that. 1741, Spirit of the Laws, a book written by a French philosopher named Montesquieu. He is the most quoted author by the writers of our U.S. Constitution, other than the Bible. And Montesquieu said there are three types of governments. Different philosophers divided governments different ways, but this is his way. He said there's republics, monarchs, despots. Republic, the people rule. Monarch is a king with a conscience, sort of limited by a parliament and traditions and religion. A despot is a king without a conscience, and he rules by caprices and whims. Montesquieu said republics, the spring, the motivating force behind it, is virtue. The people need morals and virtue in order for the republic to function. A monarchy is motivated by honor, the king honoring and dishonoring and those that serve him and does what he wants. And they don't necessarily need virtue, because the king might want him to kill people and you know, declare war and so forth. A despot is a king without a conscience, and he just can rule and kill, and life is just can be thrown away and chopped off heads and so forth. And Montesquieu says that a republic based on virtue is most prevalent in the Protestant countries of Northern Europe. Monarchy, based on honor and dishonor, is most prevalent in the Catholic countries of Southern Europe. It's very hierarchical. Despot is based on fear. That's the motivating force, that people are afraid of the despot, and they're and then he gives pleasure, if booty, if they do what he says. And that's most prevalent in Islamic countries. And so it's almost like spirit, mind, and body, right? The virtue is a idea that there is a God watching, and he's going to hold me accountable in the next life. He wants me to be fair, so I'm going to be fair even if there's no police around. The honor is, hey, I want to do what's going to honor my king, even if it means killing Indians and selling people into slavery. And the despot, the people just does what he wants for fear and pleasure.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. It's been a great program. You've been listening to We the People. Our Constitution matters.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge Piece of Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.